It's The Wonky Show. It's been budget week. We'll see what Rachel Reeves had to say for the sector. Students are feeling the pinch. We'll think about what government might do to fix that. And OFS has been publishing case studies on consumer rights. But is anyone listening? It's all coming up.
In the same regard as kind of lots of other areas, it depends on sort of DfE starting the process, and then others will have to follow suit.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly aim to this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to enjoy their penny off a pint, as usual, three cracking guests. In the Cotswolds this week, Mary Curnock-Cook is chair at the Dyson Institute in Pearson, UK. Mary, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week was the announcement that DfE is dropping the accountability measure about progression rates to Russell Group universities. As if the Russell Group needed more puff. This just had the effect of skewing applications more and more.
Good stuff. Well, link for some details in the show notes. In north of Watford, not North Watford, that's where I am, Andy Westwood is Professor of Public Policy, Government and Business at the University of Manchester. Andy, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it's got to be the budget, isn't it? I mean, for people like me, it's like Christmas. I sort of wake up early. I've got all my sort of food lined up, most of which I've eaten by about 10 a.m. It's more exciting than words can say.
Well, welcome to Boxing Day. And in Dis in Norfolk this week, Debbie McVitie is editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it's half term in this part of the country this week, which means I started the week in sunny Whitstable with a family trip to Dover Castle, which was absolutely lovely.
Sounds lovely. Now, we'll start the week then, as Andy says, with the budget. After much pre-briefing of the broad strokes, Rachel Reeves rose to her feet. Debbie, what did she have to say?
Well, I think everyone is disappointed by this budget, but maybe they shouldn't be. That's my kind of headline. At the macro level, I think this is a budget that thought to balance investment in public services with the tax increases that the Chancellor was very keen to portray would be absolutely required in order to fund that investment. The Office for Budget Responsibility has suggested that this is likely to have an impact on growth in the sense that, you know, the economy should probably continue to grow, but perhaps not at the rate that it might not have been had there been so much taxation going on. And there's all, you know, and clearly there's going to be a bit of a row going on about that. From Labour's perspective, I think the intention is very much to say let's sort of establish the foundations in this one year, and then of course there'll be a spending review next year, and then that'll set out the longer term plan. For higher education, of quite a mixed picture. There had been a lot of concerns ahead of the budget that the funding for Association to Horizon Europe would be moved, would be embedded within the current research envelope. You know, obviously then having an impact on all the other things that money is used to pay for in across the research ecosystem. That did not happen. You know, enormous sigh of relief, I think, across the piece. But the big kind of headline tax increase of a rise to employers' national insurance contributions is absolutely going to hit higher education. So it's been moved from 13.8% to 15%, and the threshold at which employers have to start paying has been reduced. And so, of course, this could add, UCA has calculated that could add to the sector's pay bill about £372 million, which will obviously enormously increase the pressure on universities. The other thing, of course, is that we had collectively, I think, expected that there might have been more for universities on the teaching side. So whether that would be a kind of formalisation of the planned of a plan of what we assume to be a planned indexation of fee increases, something around student maintenance, something around even potentially some kind of transformation fund to support universities that are really struggling financially. We didn't see any of that, and I think there's a bit of a debate raging about what that then means for the sector's finances in the year ahead.
Andy, I'm sure that there's all sorts of bits of the country that were sort of listening yesterday, waiting to work out whether they were going to be mentioned. But, you know, is it significant that Rachel Reeves rattled her way through pretty much every aspect of the state and education, but didn't talk about universities?
No, I don't think it is. I think, I mean, we've waited a long time for this budget, perhaps too long. It came after Labour's party conference. conference. That might have been a lot easier if it had come before the party conference. It came after their kind of 100 days, and it came after lots of struggles in policy presentation. But I think now we've got it, we can see that it's pretty ambitious, and we can see that it sets the parameters for all sorts of different areas of policy making. And I think it'll almost act as a bit of a laxative, I think, for government departments now to get going with their policy ideas and their particular kind of, whether it's kind of consultations or firm policy development. And so I think between now and phase two of the spending review, as they're calling it, which is now due in late spring, which is sort of May, June time, we'll have a period of pretty intense activity on universities, on further education, in local government, in the industrial strategy. And we obviously saw the sort of starts of that last week, but the sort of full version will come out in that same time frame. So I think it's really the sort of checkered flag for all that development, but it's also a big moment for all of us who are interested in trying to shape that, because this is where the sort of the real action happens. Because moving from here, where there's a degree of certainty about which direction the government's going in, what it's prioritising, what it's going to spend, how it's going to raise the money, and the spending review, will now see the sort of the real formation of policy that's going to affect the rest of the parliament. And I think all the things that you've just mentioned, Debbie, are all in that box. You know, whether it's a transformation fund, whether it's an increase to tuition fees, whether it's additional funding or additional focus funding from the R&D budget. And in a sense, all of those things are up for grabs now. And I think I wasn't sure we were ever going to get kind of some of those details. I mean, we all want those details at the earliest possible moment, but it always felt to me that the sort of Treasury had to set its stall out before those things could really happen.
Mary, obviously, you know, to some extent, what all of this suggests is, you know, it's the spending review that really matters when it comes to universities. But the government does have to announce the tuition fees for 2025, 2026 before that sort of May, June-ish time, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's, I think this pretty much means that there's not going to be a change to the tuition fee headline rate until the 2026 intake. And whether that means there will be any changes to teaching grants or whatever they're called these days, in the meantime, remains to be seen. Actually, one of the things that I was most disappointed by, but actually not surprised, was delays to the lifelong learning entitlement, which I just think gives more time for sort of passive resistance in the sector to bed in, when I feel really strongly that it's an important mechanism that could help many of them get out of their financial woes by broadening their market and the students they can attract. I mean, obviously, it also gives more time for the OFS to get its head around the additional registration category, which I don't think we've seen anything about that coming from the OFS yet, and also for the student loans company to get its systems tooled up for the new arrangements. But I think it's a real disappointment. It's like the sector just is not interested in LLE, and this just lets it kind of drift a bit further.
Debbie, I guess there's two ways of looking at this status quo question, isn't there? One is, you know, fees will be stuck at 9,250. The other is, you know, it's pretty clear that the OBR is riffing off, you know, what amounts to existing policy. And existing policy is, and certainly this is reflected in their projections, that tuition fees will go up by, you know, inflation, which is, you know, projected to be 3% in the relevant period.
Yes, this is because when Theresa May froze the fee in whatever year, 2017 or whenever it was, as part of the sort of appeal to youth ahead of at the start of her leadership of the Tory Party, there was a sort of end point of that policy, and that happens to default this year. So yes, it may be that what we just get is a statutory instrument that confirms that the fees will be index linked henceforward and sort of sets that fee accordingly for 2025-26, and that will certainly provide the sector with some relief, although not necessarily some of the kind of material change that it might be looking for. And I think it's, you know, it remains notable that over the summer, government, you know, Secretary of State Bridget Phillipson asked OFS formally, kind of alongside the appointment of interim chair David Bain, to refocus on sector finances. We've not, you know, clearly there's been lots of conversations going on behind the scenes and lots of looking at the kind of the state of sector finances and thinking about where the kind of pain points are and where the kind of areas of concern are. But there's not really been much in the way of a sort of public statement about what's going to be done, what the direction of travel is, of the sort that could perhaps reassure lenders and kind of give the, you know, create that sort of relief and a bit more headroom for the sector that could enable it to plan for the long term. So it may be that the government's calculation is that it is possible for the sector to kind of carry on as it is for the most part, perhaps with that inflationary increase sort of by the back door almost, perhaps with improved recruitment of international students. We're seeing some kind of positive straws in the wind on that front, you know, with a, you know, and it'll be able to sort of mop up the tail of institutions that are having a really, really hard time or are kind of at serious risk without needing to kind of make a sort of material policy change across the piece. That may be the calculation, and that all can wait for the spending review and create that kind of headroom for the conversation, as Andy talked about. I guess that's the best guess. I mean, the other possibility, I suppose, is that the rabbit in the hat comes a bit later. So we get a new kind of policy agenda emerging at the 11th hour, saying actually we are going to kind of work towards a new settlement. I don't know how likely that is. It's you know, given that we've got the red book, given we've got the spending projections for the year ahead, that does seem moderately unlikely.
Andy, even if there was a sort of status quo, this national insurance thing is a problem, isn't it? Because you know, every other bit of the public sector, there's a budget line that will kind of cover the impact, whereas, you know, this is one of those moments where you can flip a coin and the higher education sector is definitely not inside the public sector for the purposes of cushioning the national insurance costs increase.
No, sure, the national insurance rise will be causing lots of financial directors to rerun their spreadsheets for this year. I mean, it's a relatively small increase, but obviously it recurs, and that kind of lower threshold will have an impact. I mean, it doesn't mean that the sector still doesn't need a new financial settlement, and it will have to feed into that because employee costs are obviously going to be higher for universities. But it's just part of that bigger equation that needs to be solved in the sort of medium term, and the medium term is the next 6 months into the into phase two of the spending review.
Hmm. Andy, more generally, we've been around these houses before when you've been on about, you know, maybe the government might decide that it does need more graduates. It just needs them to be studying something different and in a different place. Now, if that's the case, it definitely needs to exert some more control. It's very hard to do that in a fully marketized demand-led system. That all points to a lot of complexity that might manifest in 2 or 3 or 4 years after some sort of, you know, proper look, review, tertiary, blah, 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 blah. So what happens in the meantime?
Well, I think that's the absolute crux of the issue. And in a sense, that's why we haven't had the amount of detail in higher education policy as lots of people might have wanted in the budget. Because there's still some really fundamental things that need thinking through. And that's, what do you want the higher education sector to do? How do you want to incentivize it to deliver those things? And that includes research as much as teaching. And what are the kind of, you know, what are the regulatory and funding sort of drivers and incentives that can really make that happen. So, you know, that requires not just significant kind of thought by ministers. It also requires the Department for Education and the Treasury and Number 10 to really think about, well, how is this going to fit in the things that really matter to us? And what we've seen in the budget is a sort of re-stressing, a reaffirmation, if you like, about how important those missions are going to be in the full spending review process. And that's, you know, we know it's about growth. The OBR have kind of delivered a sort of quite a strong assessment that the measures announced in the budget this week aren't necessarily going to deliver the growth that the government wants. So there'll be a redoubling down of what are the things that are going to do that. So in a sense, that takes us right back to, what do you want from higher education? What do you want from R&D and innovation policy? And that's going to require require some, you know, really detailed thinking. It's also going to require some really detailed thinking on behalf of institutions, because I think what this really says is that, you know, we're not going to get kind of more of that same approach that we've had for the last sort of 10 years or so, where institutions are just left to get on with it. You know, there's a sort of relatively kind of supply side approach where it's just pump out more graduates, pump out more research, and somebody else can worry about how these things get used in the local or national economy. It's going to be much more sort of holding universities' feet to the fire, if you like. These things have got to deliver growth, and any new settlement is got to be sort of organized around that. And that's complex. That's, you know, that's hard to work out. There's a lot of things there for ministers, officials, organizations, both universities and in government, to think through. But, you know, that's the task over the next 6 months. And I think those are the parameters that we need to think about.
Mary, you're the chair of what I might otherwise describe as a challenger institution, which is both small and specialist. There's obviously a bunch of providers in that space that we've talked about before on the podcast, which are in, you know, a particular kind of category, doing lots of business stuff, franchised. And then there's quite specialist and innovative providers like the one you chair. What's the fate of that kind of chunk of the sector, which often feels like it gets kind of showcased as, well, this is the answer to some of the country's problems?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that some of these new providers, you know, not just the Dyson Institute, but London Interdisciplinary School, NMITE, TEDDY, you know, those kind of organizations, they're absolutely tiny, all of them. And, you know, they're not going to make an impact on student flows, you know, in the immediate future. At Dyson, things are a bit different because it's obviously embedded within the Dyson corporate machine. And I would say that, you know, the national insurance increase will be the kind of main impact for the Dyson company. But there is a long-term commitment for the company to support the Dyson Institute. When you get to other small providers that are trying to kind of get by on a fairly normal model and have that funded by either philanthropy or fundraising in the sort of equity markets, I think it's really difficult. Anything that adds to their costs, you know, it is really hard work to get a new provider started up. So I do worry for them, and I think it would be a huge pity if something wasn't available to help them a bit. You know, they've just got huge costs trying to sort of, you know, the regulators kind of pretending they're the same as major universities. So it's tough out there for small new providers. The other thing I read was that the OBR says the increase in government borrowing is going to likely add about 0.5 percentage point to inflation. And I'm assuming that that will slow down the rate at which the Bank of England reduces rates of interest. So I just wanted to mention that as another negative impact, particularly for highly leveraged universities.
Debbie, I guess, you know, some of us were sort of dreaming that Rachel Reeves might take to her feet and discuss investment in human capital. Obviously, she said the word investment about 3,000 times yesterday when she was on her feet. Now, is it too early for that? Because, you know, it seems to me that if Andy's right and the government wants to exert a bit more control over all of this, you know, that implies public funding rather than loan funding, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I wouldn't say that she didn't, actually, because I think if you look at the section on R&D, there's a real sense that this government believes that investing in research and innovation is going to be one of the kind of absolute critical drivers of growth. And of course, if you're investing in R&D, you're investing in research projects and so on. But there's a lot about the kind of infrastructure for that and the sort of associated skills and infrastructure that you need from the system as a whole that follows on from that. You know, we're not talking kind of big numbers here, but there is that very strong sense that this is an area that the government recognises that, you know, there's one of the things that came up that the sector's been asking for is funding for proof of concept to help bridge the gap between something that is produced in a university through research funding is something that can be kind of funded by private funding, and then help to sort of demonstrate that something is commercially viable. So just little shifts like that. It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be game changing, but it's going to really help the sector do more in that kind of growth space. On the you know, education capital side, yeah. I mean, Andy's point really is that actually perhaps the government hasn't sort of decided. I mean, one of the things about LLE, and I hear what Mary's saying about the sort of, I guess, passive resistance on the part of the sector because it is going to be really hard. But, you know, putting a date on it is very helpful at the very least. And I guess giving that sort of, you know, this is the time scale in which we have to figure out how this is going to work and how it's going to be deployed in useful ways. And it's not, you know, and, you know, we know that at a sort of headline level that it's quite hard to sort of see demand in the system for short courses, you know, as things currently stand. But if the LLE ultimately kind of evolves into the way that we fund higher education, then that does open up it has all along created the space for a conversation about thinking about the delivery of higher education differently. And I think what we now need to see from government is a real getting behind that policy agenda. And, you know, this, it's not necessarily just about the kind of technical details of delivery of the LLE as a funding instrument. It's about saying, how does this change how we think about skills and participation and access and the higher education experience? And you certainly wouldn't expect every single student to be thinking about accessing higher education in a kind of stackable, disaggregated way. But opening up that opportunity changes the delivery model, right? So, you know, it's, I would say this is not nothing. It's not that the government is silent on these things. It's just perhaps not been
not
as coherent as we might like it to be.
Yeah. And then, Andy, on place specific growth. Clearly this is going to be a government that is interested in a kind of different version of levelling up, but certainly not that interested in, you know, further expanding the economic success of the existing economically successful areas of the country. It wants economic success to be spread. Where was the budget on, you know, kind of devolution, regions, cities? Where's all that at?
Well, like I say, on the sort of deluge of strategies and white papers that we can now expect to see, one of them is a devolution white paper that was mentioned explicitly in Rachel Reeves's speech. So, you know, that's going to be a big theme of not just how the government expects to govern, but also where it's going to kind of funnel the extra sort of resources that it's outlined in the budget. Obviously, the Ministry for Housing and Local Government has now got a decent settlement, both in its day-to-day spending and its sort of capital. So alongside DSIT, actually, which has got a very good settlement. And you can see across both of them, there's quite an interesting sort of set of announcements already about innovation accelerators, about continuing with the last government's policies on investment zones and free ports. And there's going to be a major emphasis on sort of local growth plans as that sort of local building block for the industrial strategy as a whole. So, you know, quite a lot of continuity there, actually. But also some quite significant sort of spending settlement. And it's worth going back to that DSIT one for a moment. You know, we've seen the sort of core budget protected, 6.1 billion. DSIT have got a kind of an overall budget of closer to 15 billion. And the government is spending kind of over 20 billion on R&D as a whole. So we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the bit of that budget that we know and love, you know, the research councils, QR, all that stuff, is in that 6.1 core research budget. But all the rest of it can drive some of these other priorities, whether that's local growth, industrial strategy, defence, health research. So, you know, there really is a lot to play for. And those sorts of pots of money, if you like, are really beginning to take shape. And I don't think anyone in research or in universities or in the kind of wider tertiary sector should lose sight of that. It's going to be a really, really big priority over the next, over the rest of this parliament.
Well, fascinating stuff. Plenty more on the site on it all. As usual, for now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Emma Griffin. I'm the president of the Royal Historical Society and a professor of history at Queen Mary University London. And this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about the Society's recent report on the value of history. The Royal Historical Society has, of course, always been interested in history, But since I became president 4 years ago, the number one reason for historians to reach out to us has been because of imminent cuts to courses and staff at their institution. For us, this simply doesn't make sense. History remains a really popular subject at school, and although numbers at university have dipped slightly recently, this dip is very modest and bears no relationship to the constant state of upset and crisis we're seeing. We know these problems are shared by many other humanities subjects too. This week, we released a report on these issues, including a survey of our members, indicating that the extent of cuts is even larger than we had realised, and that they are hitting post-92s and first-generation students the hardest. At the same time, we look at the many benefits of a history degree. We aim to help foster a more sensible conversation about the value of the humanities to our cultural fabric and how to fund them properly.
Now, next up, the bus fare cap is going up, but so is the National Living Wage. Andy, where does this leave students' finances?
Well, like higher education policy more broadly, there's not a huge amount of detail in the budget on how this is going to impact students. There are some kind of interesting little things that should be noted. Increases in the minimum wage for students that are working, part-time students, full-time students. Increases for apprentices, so that's particularly welcome, I think. But then there's the there are things in the not so good column, and increasing the bus fare cap from £2 to £3 is obviously going to be a concern for lots of people. I should say that doesn't apply in some parts of the country, so devolution is beginning to sort of stretch its legs a bit. So Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester has already said he's not going to implement that, so they'll stay at £2 there. London, the cap will continue for the rest of 2025. And I think you might see other combined authorities sort of follow suit with that. But it's a tricky one, really, in that, at the same time as the sort of, the increase in bus fares in some parts of the country, we're also seeing kind of fuel duties frozen. So if people are driving to campus, the price of petrol is still going to be maintained as it has been over the last few years. Parking, I would imagine, is probably going to go up once you get to campus. But lots of small measures. But again, I think the sense here is that we're waiting for the bigger announcements. Ministers have been pretty clear they want to make bigger announcements on student support. They don't think the current system is fair. And I think kind of we have to essentially roll that into those bigger deliberations between now and phase two of the spending review next year.
Yeah. Debbie, Mac pulled out an interesting little nugget over that bus fare cap thing, which was a report from the effectively from the bus companies that was considering what the government might do if it scrapped the bus cap and just spent money on one of the things it found was that the public quite supported the idea of students travelling for free. Now we've talked about this endlessly on the podcast, haven't we? If you're in the Department for Transport and you're thinking, right, I've got some money to spend on the poorest or whatever, or on concessionary fares or whatever, you probably don't think that students are your responsibility, or do you? Because this is the big question, isn't it? Do you try and reduce students' costs, or does DfE try and loan students more money?
Well, I mean, it's one of the things that you've identified quite a lot, Jim, is that by the same token, you could say it would be quite helpful if the Department for Work and Pensions were thinking in terms of minimum wage and the impact then on student work and those things being kind of aligned.
Well, again, we got an extension to carers allowance yesterday, didn't we? But not for full time students.
I mean, I suppose the real question is why don't they? Why are students not seen as a sort of category of person? if you were kind of chunking up citizens into pensioners and hardworking people and the economic elites who can kind of those with the broadest backs who have to bear the heaviest burdens, where do students sit in that? Why are students not perceived as being a category? And I think it is, it remains true, doesn't it? The kind of mental picture of a student is by and large, although clearly can draw down a loan, but is essentially supported by parents or families, rather than people who are often living in substandard accommodation, whose kind of core funding does not stretch to cover their daily costs, and for whom the ability to pay for things on a day to day basis is actually pretty fundamental to the kind of functioning of the country. I mean, you're boiling it down to bus fares. I think there's a real question about how do you, because you're always with students, you're never talking about one group, are you? So, some students are perfectly able to pay for bus fares, and it would be de facto policy deadweight to make it free. Some students, that would be enormously it would make an enormous difference to their ability to engage. But I don't think anybody would ever suggest at policy level means testing student. I think it would be very complicated at a policy level to say, okay, well, look, if you are if you have access to the total student maintenance loan, you also get free bus fares, and then we've got to kind of do the. So I think the until people like us can explain how you do it in policy terms, how you make that work, it will absolutely stay in the what a lovely idea, just don't bother me with it box. And I think that's kind of our job, and I think perhaps NUS's job and perhaps the sector's job as well, to really kind of say, well, what are the things that would need to happen for this to be doable at a kind of government implementation level? Because I don't think anyone in government is saying, let's make students pay more. They're just, the systems don't exist to cause that conversation to even happen.
But Mary, this is a great question, isn't it? Because, if I was working at Universities UK, I assume I would be regularly meeting with DfE ministers, DfE officials. But, if we look right across government, there's all sorts of aspects of not just student costs, but kind of student experience that matter, in all sorts of government departments. Now, if I was in a competitive spending review and I was having my budget cut, the Treasury come along and go, you can't spend all of that, I'd be keen to dump all of the problems relating to students back on DfE, wouldn't I?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm really worried about this bus fare increase. And, there was a great that article on Wonky. I think it said that if you were attending campus three times a week, it would cost a student an extra £66 a term. And if you were doing 5 days a week, it would be £110 of a term, albeit, as Andy said, some free and subsidised bus travel is available in some places. But, the fact is that students need bus travel to get to work as well as to uni. We already know that attendance at lectures and seminars is a real problem because students are working. And this cost increase just won't help when they're already massively underfunded because the maintenance loans haven't anything like kept up with inflation. And, even if they get a bit of a pay rise through the living wage increase, this is another thing to fund. There's been quite a lot in the news recently about the stalling of participation in higher education for disadvantaged students and a widening of the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And then also I read some quite eye-watering stats about the subsidies that the Bank of Mum and Dad are paying for their offspring to enjoy the full university experience. I think it was an average of about £16,000, and it just goes to show how much extra students who don't come from wealthy enough families to subsidise them, that how much extra they need to earn if they haven't got that parental support. So I think every little increase in the cost of learning for students is important, and we should have it on our radar. It's an affordability, I think, is clearly going to impact widening participation, and we may see those numbers stall even further. I think it's just another thing that makes getting by at university, if you're just relying on the maintenance loan and what you can earn, just makes it really, really hard.
Andy, there's obviously kind of what we might describe as a kind of machinery of government question here. When the housing department thinks about its renters' rights bill, or the employment, the employment bill hasn't really thought through seasonal contracts for, for students and so on. But there is this other question, isn't there, which is, how much do we loan to students? And the potentially this increase in the minimum wage could have quite a significant impact on the difference between, for example, what students in Wales can borrow and what students in England can borrow.
Yeah, well, that's another aspect of kind of how devolution is changing things here. And I think that's probably the most significant thing to think about in that regard. So, again, it's not just in Greater Manchester, but most mayors ran on a campaign in England, ran on a campaign in May of re-regulating kind of the buses and public transport in their particular geographical areas. So, the reality is that sort of if you've got a mayor in a combined authority, they're going to look at this rather more in the round than national government tends to. It's also true that, going back to buses, that the routes that universities are on tend to be the ones that cross-subsidise all the other bus routes. So if you're a mayor, that's where the money-making potential is. So, you know, we know that mayors haven't got loads of cash, even with a decent settlement for the department in the budget. So, you know, so there are lots of kind of contradictions here. But I think kind of what we see in Wales and what we see in English city regions is a sense that you're much more likely to see the sort of interests of students kind of reflected in policy if it's made at that level, rather than if it's made at the kind of, you know, the traditional sort of departmental level. I mean, the reality with buses and the cap is that in the Department of Transport, this was a good way of saving £100 million. And did students come into that spreadsheet? Almost certainly not. And I think it's the same across lots of other departments, whether they're thinking about, even if they're thinking about increases to kind of minimum wage or whatever. So I think that kind of localization, that devolution of things tends to put more focus on the interests of students in a local place than that sort of national regime, if you like. So that's one to watch over the next 2 or 3 years as mayors get to re-regulate buses and get more powers for other stuff. And of course, as we see kind of the Welsh government think about student support in their own way. And I think that's a good thing.
Debbie, obviously in the run-up to the debate, there was this endless you know set of questions about who counted as a hardworking person. hardworking family. Who's a working person? And of course, you know, the reality is that the Treasury's own distributional impact assessment yesterday on the budget continues to make that mistake of counting tuition fee income as actual income in household income. So it completely obscures the kind of poverty that some students are in. And, you know, certainly if we think about childcare, students are not regarded as working and therefore can't get the free 15 hours of childcare. Why is it that we're not there's a big debate about whether landlords are working people, but we're not having that debate about whether students are hardworking?
Well, I mean, you know, number one, obviously that glitch should just be fixed. And it's one of those things that it ought to be quite straightforward. You know, it's like VAT on shared services. It ought to be sort of fairly straightforward. And yet, you know, the Treasury is arcane and does things in mad ways. And that's, you know, there's an influencing agenda there to be kind of got to the bottom of. This question about who's a hardworking person, I mean, there's a sort of political calculus here from Labour is absolutely about how they're going to win the next election. And, you know, I think it is also absolutely about trying to kind of get public services to a kind of functioning state and achieve the foundations for growth. I don't think it's cynical in that sense. But if you look at things like fuel duty, the penny on the pint, the substantial investment in the NHS, this is about gambling on that a particular category of voter, which is that sort of broadly sort of squeezed middle, you know, category, will see enough change off the back of these measures to feel like they can continue to support Labour at the next election. And it continues to be true that I think for as long as the student vote is either kind of taken for granted or not seen as particularly influential in the political landscape, that students will continue to not be categorised as hardworking people, because it's the hardworking people that, you know, substitute future Labour voters. And that's the calculus, isn't it?
It's some of this anti-Corbyn stuff. You know, we don't want to sound like Corbyn. We don't want to be pandering to students.
Why won't government think about students in that way? I think kind of government's problem at the moment is that it's hard enough to think about who hardworking people are. I suspect they'll never use that terminology again, given the rough ride they had in the budget, rather than try and seek to involve more people in the definition or not. So don't be surprised if that, you know, if that term is not bandied about again. And I wouldn't kind of advise a campaign to include students in the definition, because it'll only make them nervous. So I think government does need to think about students in respect of all sorts of different policy areas. But that's not going to happen until DfE works out how it's going to think about students. And so the sort of signal for how this government's going to think about students in the round starts with DfE making up its mind with the support of the Treasury about how it's going to support students, what it's going to give them, what it's going to loan them, how they're going to make it pay it back, and where that leaves them in their sort of day-to-day existence. So, you know, in the same regard as kind of lots of other areas, it depends on sort of DfE starting the process, and then others will have to follow suit.
Jim, there's one other sort of quite simple answer to why they don't think of students as hardworking people or whatever it is, and that is because they are in quote unquote full-time education. You know, the reality is we all know that full-time education isn't anything like full-time, not least because quite a lot of students are doing in effect a full-time job as well. But, you know, we carry on calling this full-time education. That's another reason why I think LLE is really important, because it will actually cause people to think more carefully about, you know, how students need to live and work and study. And we can perhaps get away from this sort of ludicrous hangover from past decades or even centuries about what full-time education means.
Well, fascinating stuff. As ever, plenty more on the site on all of this. Now, every week this season, we're having a think about how things were and how things came to be. With City St George's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
One of the phrases we know about higher education is this term town and gown. It sets up an opposition between the university and the townspeople around it. And this comes from the oldest parts of our sector and, to some extent, has shaped some of the changes all the way from the beginning. The oldest document in the University of Oxford archives is the outcome of the riots in 1209. The university shut down after a bloody conflict between town and gown. Some of the members of the university stayed away forever, remaining in Cambridge. A townswoman had been murdered by a student, and the townspeople helpfully executed a different student in revenge. Membership of the university was key. A key focus of it at the time was theology. So there were clerks. They were in some form of clerical rule, and therefore this fell into that Plantagenet problem of the area of jurisdiction of the king over the church. This king, John, was currently excommunicated, and so it was the papal legate who was put in charge of sorting this out. He sided with the university, granting it powers over the town and putting its members beyond the authority of the town's authorities. Low-level disputes continued. If you look through the letters from the king to Oxford, there's all sorts of things about stopping pigs roaming in the streets or stopping people slaughtering in the town because the smell was so bad. But this finally gets to a height at the riot that occurs on St. Scholastica's Day. In 1345, some students and priests were drinking in the Swindle Stock Tavern at Carfax, right in the heart of town, and started to complain about the quality of the wine. The landlord responded to the complaint with stubborn and saucy language, whereupon the student threw a quart pot over his head. Local people came to his aid, and the bell was rung, and the university retaliated by rousing its students to lay into the fray. People came from outside the town to join in, and the riot took on a very, very serious effect. In all, 62 scholars were killed. The riots were severely punished afterwards. The king decided to punish the townsmen of Oxford with an annual ritual humiliation that continued for 500 years. Every St. Scholastica's Day thereafter, the mayor and bailiffs had to attend a mass for the souls of the dead and to swear an annual oath to observe the university's privileges. They had to bring 62 citizens with them, representing the number of scholars slain, and hand over 63 pence, usually in small silver coins. This kept getting regularised, so Queen Elizabeth enforced this rule and setting out the terms of the oath that people would have to swear. You shall swear that truly you shall observe and keep them all manner of lawful liberties and customs of the said university, which the Chancellor, Masters and Scholars of the said university have reasonably used, without any gainsaying, saving your fidelity to the Queen's Majesty, so help you God. There was a moment where at least one mayor decided not to play along. Thomas Dennis, the mayor in 1643, decided not to appear and was summoned, but his complaint of why he didn't come was the original reason was superstitious, and perhaps they often jeered at by the scholars that they had to come and do this act. But it continued. Eventually, in the 19th century, they were let out of having to go to the church to deliver the money and were just invited round to the vice-chancellor's house, where they would pay the money in a smaller ceremony. But finally, Mr. Isaac Grubb, then the mayor, decides he wasn't going to play at all. he didn't turn up. But the good news was that after a certain amount of discussion, in which it said that he stated in emphatic language what he'd be before he'd stand it, the university did nothing about his refusal, and the ceremony stopped. There was a celebration to mark the end of this process, but that's it. No more trailing the University of Oxford, the people of Oxford having to trail to the University of Oxford to give them 63 pence to make up for killing 63 scholars.
Now, finally this week, the Office for Students this week published two more consumer rights case studies. Mary, what's this all about?
Well, to be honest, Jim, I couldn't get too excited about this. These are cases where the OFS has intervened about a contract that a provider has with its students, and it relates to compliance with Competitions and Markets Authority and National Trading Standards. It kind of gives us two case studies, which I think will be relevant to providers that are similar to the two providers in this release this week. So one is a small private provider, which I'm guessing none of us have ever heard of before, delivering mostly business courses under franchise arrangements with other universities. It's called Fairfield Business School.
And I know it well. Know it well. One of the many in Ilford.
It's drawn its contract with students in very broad terms, basically attempting to give itself the widest possible freedoms to change courses, change course content, change timetables, in other words, to change what a student has thought they were signing up for when they signed on. And they've been called out for that, and they've changed their contracts. Then the second case was Oxford Brookes, obviously a long established and reputable university. And again, the case tests their compliance with CMA and trading standards. In Brooks's case, they've just removed the clauses which attempted to limit their liability and say things like industrial action amounted to force majeure and that students therefore couldn't be compensated for any disruption. In my view, quite rightly, they were advised that this was an issue in their control, and they've changed their contracts. And I think probably quite a few other universities have got similar clauses in their contracts, albeit there's a few who are waiting for the outcome of the COVID-related class action, which I think is with UCL, isn't it? And everyone's waiting for the long promised consultation on the C conditions with the OFS, which could see us move towards more to something that looks like a kind of nationally compliant contract. To be honest, I'm not sure there's really a story here other than, sloppy governance around core documents or, a failure to consult lawyers when drawing them up. I think for the Fairfield Business School, it's perhaps another signal that for-profit providers are actually more interested in profit than in their students.
Debbie, I guess the really interesting question here is, when Joe Johnson launched HERA, he was banging on about this issue, and that was a long time ago. And we still don't really feel like we've made significant progress, do we?
Well, I think so. OFS has published a list of contract terms that it would consider to be unfair, and that's that refers to the CMA, and there's a partnership with the National Trading Standards. So there's a general movement here. I think the thing that's kind of perplexing people is why is it being done in this sort of weird reversy-persy sort of way? So I sort of find myself going, how did in a few different cases. In this particular instance, how was it that Oxford Brookes and Fairfield School of Business came to the attention of OFS? Did somebody make a report? Was somebody just kind of browsing the internet and went, oh, those look like unfair standards. Let's start an investigation. When it's as clear cut as there are a bunch of standards or a bunch of contract terms that are kind of probably in fairly kind of significant use across the sector that are actually fundamentally quite problematic if you compare them against, the kind of core guidance from CMA and trading standards. We sort of expect everyone to fix those. I don't underestimate the work involved with multiple providers, but it does feel like the way to do that is to say, right, well, here is a kind of model contract that everyone has to sign up to or explain why not, or actually conduct a review, perhaps through sampling or something to say, right, we've looked into everyone's contract and we're now kind of confident that by and large, the sector is kind of delivering fair T's and C's. I think going in on a sort of case by case basis feels a bit odd, but I don't claim to be kind of well versed in regulatory approaches, but there's something about, you know, this feels quite easily fixable. And I think there's maybe this kind of maybe driving Mary sense that it's kind of like, why are we talking about this? Because surely it ought to just be everyone agrees these are not good contract clauses. Everyone changes their contract. Job done. Moving on.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to go in deep on anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKAG, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Mary, Andy, Debbie, Michael, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.